Welcome to the New Life Podcast, a ministry of New Life Presbyterian Church in Ithaca, New York. Today we have this week's sermon preached by Tim LaCroix, our senior pastor. Join us for worship each week at 10 o'clock at 950 Danby Road, Ithaca, New York. You can also visit us on our website, www.newlifeithaca.org. Now here's this week's sermon.
A reading of the Holy Gospel of St. Matthew, chapter 1, verses 1 through 6a. Please stand if you are able. This is the genealogy of Jesus, the Messiah, the son of David, the son of Abraham. Abraham was the father of Isaac. Isaac, the father of Jacob. Jacob, the father of Judah and his brothers. Judah, the father of Perez and Zerah, whose mother was Tamar. Perez, the father of Hezron. Hezron, the father of Ram. Ram, the father of Amminadab. Amminadab, the father of Nahshon. Nahshon, the father of Salmon. Salmon, the father of Boaz, whose mother was Rahab. Boaz, the father of Obed, whose mother was Ruth. Obed, the father of Jesse. And Jesse, the father of King David. The Gospel of the Lord.
Glory to you, O Lord.
Thanksgiving was this week, as you all well know, and I hope that all of you had a wonderful feast, good food, good drink, good company, good time to be together and give thanks for all the good gifts that the Lord has given us. I love Thanksgiving. I particularly love the food of Thanksgiving. I enjoy preparing the turkey. I like to smoke the turkey and put a lot of time and effort into it, make notes for how to do it better the following year. And we also love the fixins, as we say down south, all the fixins that go with Thanksgiving. But the most important part of Thanksgiving is the people, right? To spend a time of feasting and celebration with other people, to enjoy good food, good drink, with loved ones and those that we enjoy being around. That's really the point of the holidays, isn't it? To enjoy and celebrate with other folks. But Thanksgiving isn't always so peachy. We are all very well aware that when people get together this time of year, things sometimes don't always go as well as they could. In fact, there is a lot of talk these days, and in fact, I've seen admonitions and exhortations on various forms of social media for people to be civil during the holidays. Indeed, we know that it's a bit of a trope that when people get together who don't normally spend a lot of time together, family members that perhaps only see each other once or twice a year, typically, and I'll cast this in the most positive light possible, typically you run out of things to talk about. So when you run out of things to talk about, what do? Well, you talk about the weather. That only lasts for a little bit, you know. Then what do you talk about? Well, you inevitably start talking about things that you care about, things that matter a lot to you. They say that the things we shouldn't talk about at Thanksgiving are politics and religion. Invariably, someone will begin to talk about something that they assume everyone else agrees with, again, casting in the best light. But not everybody does. People are offended. Maybe arguments break out. Food gets thrown. Dishes get broken. This sort of thing is good material for comedians. Rachel and I were watching some reruns of Saturday Night Live Thanksgiving sketches last night. And they love to pick on this thing. One of the sketches that we watched last night was a typical family, siblings, daughter, grandparents, sitting around a table. And invariably, every time they start talking, someone says something absurd, other people get offended, and they start fighting. Now, that's typical, and the way they did it was funny in an absurdist way they did it. But the funny part of this sketch was whenever they would start fighting, the little girl, the only child at the table, would get up from the table and go over to a CD player. This was set about 12 years ago. And push play on the CD player, and Adele would start playing. Adele, the song Hello. And whenever Adele would start playing, everyone would stop fighting, and they would start singing. Adele brought people together. The sketch is called The Miracle of Thanksgiving, if you want to look it up. So a few bits of the song would play, people would sing, and then the oven timer would go off or something else would distract them, and they would go back to talking and inevitably arguing. The kid would go up and hit play again, and they would start singing again. And as the sketch progresses, you know, they are going further and further into the music video, and they are acquiring accoutrements of Adele, first painted nails and then wigs, and eventually they are full on, no longer in the dining room, but full on in the music video doing the Adele thing. And it's quite humorous. Again, I can't do it justice, so I encourage you to watch it yourself. There's another Thanksgiving trope that often happens, or at least people talk about, and that is the unwanted person that comes to the meal. The unwanted person. Maybe it's a black sheep of the family. Someone has been blackballed from the family. And someone invites this person to Thanksgiving. Perhaps they hope that it'll be the beginning of reconciliation. But inevitably what happens is a couple of people are over in the corner and they whisper, "What's she doing here? What's she doing here?" It could be a significant other that people don't quite accept. It could be a friend that has different politics, different religion, different race, different morals, and someone in the corner whispers, "What's she doing here?" In the gospel text today, we have a "what's she doing here" moment. We read in Matthew chapter 1 about the genealogy of Jesus, and this is the boring part where everybody falls asleep. But trust me, if you actually if you actually went back and did a little research into all these people and what they did, it's not boring at all. It's quite exciting. But there's some people who show up in this genealogy, and the ancestors of Jesus, where people are whispering, "What's she doing here?" In fact, there are four women mentioned. Three women mentioned. And each of these women are a little bit out of place, not very respectable. Four women. I was right the first time. As we look at the text, we see the first woman is Tamar, the father of Perez, or so the mother of Perez and Zerah. And the story of Tamar is not one that I shall repeat. I encourage you to go read it yourself. It would not be PG. Let's just put it that way. Someone who's not very respectable, or at least an event that's not very respectable in the story of Christ. Then we have the story of Rahab, which we read in the text that Benjamin read from Joshua chapter 2, was a prostitute. Certainly people were saying, "What's she doing here?" Then we have Ruth, who's a foreigner, a Moabitess, of descendants of the daughters of Lot. "What's she doing here?" It's interesting because there are other genealogies in the Bible. If we take a look at the genealogy at the end of Ruth, for example, and we're going to talk about Ruth next week. But the genealogy at the end of Ruth covers this same territory. You know, it covers the father of so-and-so. It goes Nashon, the father of Salmon, Salmon, the father of Boaz, Boaz, the father of Obed, Obed, the father of Jesse, Jesse, the father of David, the king. This is a direct quotation from the ending of Ruth, except for the introduction of two women. Why does Matthew introduce the women into the story? I think there are several reasons why he introduces the women into the story. But perhaps it's because there's a sketchy woman at the bottom. Mary, an unwed teenage mother, someone who does not come from the kind of lineage and family that the other people of this genealogy does. If you read this genealogy, it reads like a Judaic Hall of Fame. Look at all the people that appear in this genealogy. It starts with Abraham, the patriarch, and Isaac and Jacob, the fathers of their people and their faith. Then it moves on to Judah, the head of the great tribe of Judah, the main and largest tribe that still existed at the time of Jesus. It goes through the kings of Israel, starting with David, and then moving to Solomon and Rehoboam and Abijah and Asaph and Jehoshaphat and Joram and Uzziah and Jotham and Ahaz and Hezekiah. Maybe you've heard of Hezekiah. Manasseh, Amos, and Josiah. Then they go into exile, and we have two other kings, Jeconiah and Zerubbabel. All these kings are present. And then, of course, at the end of the genealogy in chapter 1, we have other very respectable Jewish people. We have Jacob, the father of Joseph, Mathan, the father of Jacob, and, of course, Joseph, who was from a very respectable family. But the people that Matthew adds to the genealogy are not respectable people. They are people that don't fit. They're people that the folks in the corners are saying, "What's she doing here?" Indeed, what is she doing here? Today is the first Sunday of Advent, and Advent is a season to reflect upon the state of things. In many different traditions, as I've told you before, and I'll keep kind of repeating this, Advent is treated as pre-Christmas. You know, we're going to do Christmas a little earlier. We're going to continue our celebration, extend it out a few weeks. But as I've said often, and a pastor friend of mine repeated in a conversation that I was taking part of this week, Christmas is dessert. And before we get to dessert, we need to eat our liturgical vegetables. You know, our culture goes straight to feasting. Our culture goes straight to celebrating. We move, well, sometimes from Halloween or even Labor Day to Christmas these days. It just depends on the store. But we want to go straight to the good parts. But anyone who's ever been in therapy knows that you can't just skip to the good parts without dealing with the bad stuff. No one ever got better. No one ever healed from a difficult thing without living into the hard things of life. There's no way to get healing from the bad things that you've been through by never addressing them, by never talking about them, by never taking a deep inventory of the darkness, as Fleming Rutledge said. Indeed, the only way that you can really have experience good feelings without dealing with the hard things is by taking substances. Those will make you feel good without dealing with the hard stuff, but they won't make you better. It only takes the edge off for a while. It only makes you feel good until it's ended. The only way really to heal is to, as Fleming Rutledge said, take a fearless inventory of the darkness. And that is what Advent is all about. We need to eat our liturgical vegetables. We need to take a fearless inventory of the darkness. You know, I've heard people that are Christmas curmudgeons, they don't really like Christmas all that much. They don't have very much of a Christmas spirit. One may even say they were Scrooges. Why is it that people don't like Christmas? I think the reason why people don't like Christmas is they haven't taken a fearless inventory of the darkness. Because if we took a really strong look at the darkness of the pain and the sorrow and the brokenness in this world, if we really took that seriously and took a long look at it and took a long look at our part, the part that we play in that brokenness and in that sorrow, if we lived into that and if we cried out to God for deliverance of that brokenness, of that pain, of that oppression, how could we not celebrate when the one comes who will deliver us from it all? And that's what Christmas is. If we get tired of Christmas by Boxing Day, perhaps we haven't been doing it according to how we're supposed to be doing it. And so we have Advent for a few weeks. I know we'll be celebrating. We have a Christmas party on the 13th. I'm not some kind of like purist on this. But we're going to lean into this for a few weeks. We're going to lean into preparation. We're going to lean into the pain of this world. Today we lean into the pain of Jesus' family line. And we're going to do this for 3 weeks. The mothers of Jesus, those who mother Jesus, who bring forth the Messiah. Today we find a woman named Rahab, and she is not somebody who belongs in this illustrious hall of fame that we read about in Matthew chapter 1. Why is she here? Well, I'm going to cover 3 main points today. But the first reason that she's here is because Jesus welcomes unrespectable people into his family. Jesus welcomes all kinds of people into his family. Someone pointed out, I was reading different things about this passage, and I listened to a talk gave by a lady who worked, or at least it was published by CDM, which is the PCA's Christian education wing. She pointed out that Jesus is the only person who ever chose his family. None of us choose our family. We can't choose our biological family. We can choose our significant others. We can choose our friends. You know, we can choose our found family, which is a popular term used today. But you can't choose your biological family. You can't choose your mother. You can't choose your father. You can't choose your siblings. You don't have a choice. They are simply given to you. The only person who ever chose his family was Jesus. So he chose. He chose the people that are mentioned here in Matthew chapter 1. He put them there for a reason. Now, I wanted you to do a thought experiment. If you could design your ancestors, if you could design your family line, who would you put in? I imagine we would put very smart people, very successful people, very powerful people. Perhaps we would try to do a little bit of genetic engineering. We'd put some strong people in there, some beautiful people in there. We'd want to make that thing good. Let me ask you a question. If you were designing your family tree, would you put a prostitute in there? I don't think we would. Would you put a foreigner in there? Would you put people who are unrespectable? But Jesus did. Why did he do that? He did that because he welcomes all kinds of people into his family. He welcomes even a person like Rahab into his family. The lesson we learn from this is that loyalty to Yahweh matters far more than respectability when it comes to God's family and God's kingdom. Loyalty to God, faithfulness to Yahweh, matters far, far more than respectability in God's family. Why is Rahab included? She is included because she was loyal to Yahweh. She was loyal to him, and she protected the spies, and she made a way for the people of Israel to obtain victory. And so Jesus welcomes all kinds of people into his family. And so the lesson for us is, I told the kids, if you remember anything about this sermon today, remember this. God accepts all kinds of people into his family. You don't have to be the prettiest. You don't have to be the smartest, the cleverest. You certainly don't have to be the one who is holy and pure. God accepts all sorts of people into his family. He even puts some of the most unrespectable, sketchy people in his family line. How much should that tell you that he accepts all kinds of people, that in order to be a part of his family, you don't have to measure up first? In other words, it's not about your past. It's about your future. And who determines that but Christ himself? So the second point is this. Rahab was saved by faith. Rahab was saved by faith. We see this pointed out by the writer of Hebrews, which I've told you before, I think is Paul, and that won't surprise you when I say that. But Hebrews chapter 11 is the hall of faith. It's called the hall of faith because it lists all these people that that were heroes of the faith, kind of like Matthew chapter 1, but a little different. And then in Hebrews 11, the writer mentions Abel. It starts with Abel and goes to Enoch and Noah, and then it goes to Abraham, and it goes to all the heroes of the faith, to Moses. But interestingly enough, the last person that it mentions in the line is Rahab. Rahab is mentioned last. Rahab is mentioned in verse 31 at the end of this section. By faith, Rahab the prostitute did not perish with those who were disobedient because she had given a friendly welcome to the spies. If you have learned anything about when I talked to you about ancient lists, the most important parts of ancient lists or poetic lists are the first thing and the last thing. The first person mentioned is Abel, righteous Abel, the first of the line of the seed of the woman who would crush the head of the serpent. And the last one mentioned is Rahab, the person who tells us that the way you become a part of the hall of faith is to be a person of faith. Rahab was saved by faith. You might think that, so why did Rahab change her loyalty? Why did she change her loyalty from her city and her people and her gods over to Yahweh? You might think maybe it was a conversion of convenience. That could be a legitimate conclusion to come to. Rahab saw the writing on the wall. She had a house in the wall, had a window looking out. Maybe she could see what was happening. She understood that the tide was going, and she decided to place her bets on the folks that were outside the city. So maybe it was a conversion of convenience. You know, maybe it was because she saw a way out. What we know about prostitution in the ancient world and also today is that many people who are involved in it, the vast majority do not want to be involved in it. In fact, many of them who are coerced or enslaved into this state. And so perhaps this was the way for her. Perhaps the reason why she's accepted. And I find it fascinating that in Joshua, there is no comment. There's no comment about her other than her line of work. No other comment about her respectability, making an apology for accepting her into God's family. None of it. And I think perhaps the reason is because she was an oppressed person and the children of Israel recognized that. So was it a conversion of convenience? Did she see a way out of her status, a way out of her enslavement by aligning herself with these foreign people? The New Testament says no. The New Testament says it was a sincere conversion. The writer of Hebrews says that it was by faith that she did this. In other words, she sincerely switched her allegiance over to that of God and over to God's people. And she was received. She was accepted. How is it that she was accepted? A foreigner, a person of a, as I say, sketchy background. How was it that she was accepted by God's people? Well, one of the things we have to remember is that the people that we read about in Joshua, they were the second generation of those that came out of Egypt. The first generation were the people who grumbled. The first generation were the people who didn't want to enter into the land because of fear. The first generation are those who rebelled against God and against Moses. That generation died in the wilderness. And this generation who entered in, who are entering into the promised land, were the faithful generation. These are those who trust in Yahweh with all their heart. These are the ones who heard the word of Moses when Moses said that God is a God for the widow, a God for the fatherless, that God was telling them they have to care for the foreigner, they have to care for the oppressed, they have to give them judgment and justice. These are people who understood those teachings, and perhaps when they saw Rahab, these two spies, and the rest of the people, they saw someone that God said they should care for, and they did. But she was saved by faith, which means she became a believer in God and she confessed and believed in the forgiveness of God. This is what I think that the scarlet thread is about. Now, people have made a lot of hay, preachers over the years have made a lot of hay about the scarlet thread, saying it represents the blood of Christ. I think that connection is tenuous. It's always hard to move forward in time with these sort of connections, but it's always a much better interpretive choice to go backward in time. And if we go backward in time about something red being applied to a window or a doorway, what do we think of? We think of the Passover. In fact, if we look at Joshua chapter 2, we find that just three chapters later, the people of Israel celebrate the Passover at the end of chapter 5. What is the logical connection to the scarlet thread hung on a window when a people are about to be destroyed, but the Passover? And so what is the connection here? That Rahab is aligning herself to the God of the Old Testament. She is aligning herself to Yahweh. She is putting the blood of the covenant on her door. She is by faith entering into the family of God. And so for us, we know through Rahab's example that the way we enter into the family is by faith. We do not enter into the family by works. We do not enter into the family by respectability. Not only does God accept all kinds of people into his family, no one gets into it by their own effort, by their own merit, by their own goodness. Everyone comes in not because of their past, but because of their future. All people come in not to God's family because God has put his name upon them and chosen them. And everyone comes into God's family because they believe in him. They are saved by faith. But lastly, we see that Rahab comes into God's family and she is saved by works. This is what James interestingly points out, and I think it is an important place to leave us. In James chapter 2 is the only other person to mention Rahab. There's four mentions of Rahab in the Bible, in Joshua, then in Matthew chapter 1, in Hebrews 11, and James 2. Four times she's mentioned. The letters Rahab appear in other places, but they don't refer to her. It's just the same letters that refer to basically a sea serpent. So you'll see that if you did a word search, you would see it comes up in other places. But the person, Rahab, only appears in Joshua, Matthew 1, Hebrews 11, and James 2. James, interestingly enough, says almost the opposite about Rahab. James has a kind of a hall of faith as well. He talks about Abraham. He talks about others. He also ends with Rahab. In verse 25, this is what James says. He says in chapter 2, verse 25, "And in the same way was not also Rahab the prostitute justified by works when she received the messengers and sent them out by another way. For as the body apart from the spirit is dead, so faith apart from works is dead." Earlier, James says, "You are not justified by faith alone, but by works." Biblical interpreters have had a lot of trouble with James over the years. Martin Luther especially didn't like James very much. He called it the epistle of straw. And the reason is because James explicitly says you are not saved by faith alone, and salvation by faith alone was a pretty important doctrine for Martin Luther. But if you look carefully at what's going on between Paul and between James, You see that there is no contradiction. Paul is saying that we come into the faith, we come into the family of God by faith alone. We can only come into the family of God by a sincere, heartfelt conversion, a change of heart, by belief in God. That's the only way we can come in to the faith. It is not because of who we are, but because of whose we are. So James is not saying that we don't come into the family of God by works. What he's saying is the faith that justifies us is not alone. The kind of faith that saves us is a faith that works itself out in righteousness, in good works, and in good deeds. And Rahab proves this. Rahab was not saved by faith, a faith that is alone, but a faith that worked itself out. Rahab's works in remaining faithful to the word that she gave the spies and switching her allegiance to Yahweh, and understandably, and in her story, putting aside her sinful past and moving into righteousness with God's people. She married into the best family in Israel. She married into the family, the tribe of Judah, and indeed hitched her wagon to a princely line that would eventually be the kingly line of David and Solomon and the rest. Rahab was accepted because she was one who practiced her faith. She changed her ways. She put away her sin, imperfectly, of course, as we all have. But she was justified by works. She was saved by works. So this idea that you can come into the family of God and not put aside our sinful past and sinful ways is also incorrect. There is a change of life that accompanies a change of heart. There are works that accompany faith. And every person who is converted will work that out in their lives with righteous good works. James is not saying, and I'm not saying, that we earn favor by those works. But what James is saying and what I am saying is unless you have a faith that works itself out in righteousness, your faith is dead. Rahab was saved by works. Rahab was saved by faith. And Jesus invites all kinds of people into his family. This is how the early church was. You've heard me talk about this before, and you'll hear me talk about it many more times if I continue to be your pastor for a long time. The early church was made up of not powerful people. They weren't politically connected. They weren't wealthy. The early church was made up of a bunch of women, children, people that were oppressed, people that were set aside by their families, by people who were enslaved and poor. The church was made up of, in other words, outcasts and people who weren't powerful. And it was looked down upon by a lot of folks because of that very reason. But you see, the fact that the church was made up of such kinds of people, all kinds of people, people like Rahab, people like Ruth, it did not mean that it was a powerless faith. It did not mean that it was a powerless group of people. For indeed, as that group of people, the powerless, the impoverished, the enslaved, the looked down upon, the broken of this world, continued in their acts of faithfulness, continued in their acts of righteousness, and loving and serving each other and being hospitable to those around them and caring for the poor and the widow and the fatherless, they grew and grew and grew until they did what no other kingdom on the earth could do. They took down the most powerful empire in the world, the Roman Empire. Indeed, Christianity is a place for those who are broken and downtrodden to be and to exist and to become conquerors. Johnny Erickson Tada is a person that maybe some of you have heard of. She had an accident and was paralyzed in her early life. And she became a Christian writer and thinker and someone who just welcomes all kinds of people in. She has a program, used to be a radio program called Johnny and Friends. She's written books. She learned how to paint with her mouth. It's quite impressive. But she wrote a book called The Glorious Intruder, and this is what she said. She said, God is an intruder. He encroaches, presumes, invades, and infringes. He crashes the party. He tears aside curtains. He throws open locked doors. He is a light switch into a dark room. God pulls the fire alarm in stuffy, sacrosanct hallways. We might add, God invites prostitutes into his family. God is a glorious intruder in my life, in my thoughts, in my pain, in my sorrow, in my brokenness. And this God intruded on Rahab in her life. And she became a follower of his, and he welcomed her in. And because of her faith and her faithfulness, the world was changed forever, and she became a mother of Jesus.
Thank you for listening to this week's podcast. Please rate and review us on your podcast service and share with anyone who may be interested. The intro and outro music for the New Life podcast is provided by Sandra McCracken with her permission. Please visit her website at sandramccracken.com. We'll see you next week.